This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is not some sudden outbreak of good tidings in legislative productivity.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow, and this is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. And we have an outstanding panel today. Returning to the roundup is Zach Jakowski. Zach is a Democratic political consultant from North Carolina. He's a principal at Title Fight and the founder and CEO of Brackus Solutions. Previously, he has served as the campaign manager for Katie Hill's successful congressional campaign, flipping a seat from red to blue, and as our political director at the Lincoln Project. Zach, welcome back.
Ron, thanks so much for having me on today.
Also returning to the roundup is Liam Donovan. Liam has nearly two decades of experience working at the intersection of politics and policy. He's currently a principal at Bracewell LLP and spent two election cycles at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, where we work together. He is also the host of a great podcast called The Lobby Shop. Liam, welcome back. Great to have you.
Always a pleasure.
Up first this week, we've finally got aid for Ukraine and Israel through Congress. We will talk about that and Speaker Mike Johnson's move to buck his MAGA colleagues to bring that to the floor. Then we will talk about the anti-Israel illegal encampments at college campuses across the country, the concerns about safety for Jewish students, plot to disrupt the Democratic Convention, and what all this means for Biden. After that, we're going to talk about the safe space election, as Axios has termed it, that is, how both Biden and Trump are shunning serious journalists and spending their time only talking to friendly media. Then we'll talk about what other political developments Zach and Liam are paying attention to and why. And finally, in a separate episode just for our Politicology Plus members, we are going to dive into some of the more unsavory campaign and political fundraising practices you may have never heard of and why there aren't any incentives for anyone to change them. Actually, this plus topic was Zach's idea, so he's going to set this one up. It's going to be a fun ride. If you are a Politicology Plus member, thank you. Politicology exists because of you. If you are not yet a member and you want to join us for that conversation, go to politicology.com/plus and you can unlock all of those hidden episodes in between our regularly scheduled ones with an ad-free listening experience. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus or click the link in your show notes.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Okay. The long-awaited aid package has now been signed into law by President Biden. It is a $95 billion security supplemental. It was long stalled by Republican House members, and it took four back-to-back votes with bipartisan coalitions to get it done. Quick breakdown, $60 billion for Ukraine. The vote on that was 311 to 112, with the majority of Republicans voting against it. $26 billion for Israel, vote was 366 to 58. $8 billion for Indo-Pacific, that is Taiwan. The vote was 385 to 34. It also contained a measure that would pave the way to sell off frozen Russian sovereign assets to help fund the Ukrainian war effort, something that everyone needs to understand is quite a controversial move. There is also a new round of sanctions on Iran and a law that would force a sale of Chinese-owned TikTok to U.S. investors. That is constitutionally dubious, to say the least. We're not sure if that's actually going to stand up, but it certainly wouldn't happen before the election because the law gives about a year for that to happen. So, the sanctions plus TikTok was 360 to 58 on the vote. Notably, the law does not include a border security deal. After signing the legislation, Biden held a press conference and took a swing at Republicans for that. Let's roll the clip.
But there's one thing this bill does not do: border security. You know, just this year, I proposed and negotiated and agreed to the strongest border security bill this country has ever, ever, ever seen. It was bipartisan. It should have been included in this bill. And I'm determined to get it done for the American people. But I'll come back to that in another moment, another time.
Yep, another time. The House and Senate have been at an impasse on that for months. So this aid package and the TikTok ban obviously has huge implications for foreign policy and the U.S. position in the world, but we're going to focus today on domestic politics. The biggest takeaway is that Mike Johnson actually got this done. He knew it was going to infuriate his right flank. He knew it could cost him his speakership. Marjorie Taylor Greene has a motion to vacate already submitted that she could force a vote on at pretty much any time. Congressman Thomas Massie and Paul Gosar are on board with her plan. Speaker Johnson had met repeatedly with national security officials after the Senate passed their aid package, and he prayed. Michael McCall told the New York Times that Johnson told him, quote, "I want to be on the right side of history." And here's what Johnson said.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important.
Politico is also reporting that the White House, Chuck Schumer, and Mitch McConnell all worked together on moving Johnson. Johnson obviously had opposed Ukraine aid when he was a rank-and-file member. And McConnell also said, this is interesting, that Johnson, quote, neutralized the former president on this issue. So with that set up, how did you both react to this development? Liam, why don't you lead off?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think this was the best outcome you could have hoped for, certainly a week or two ago. I mean, it was not necessarily trending this way, either in terms of a relatively smooth passage of this bill or a, you know, relatively anticlimactic enactment, in the sense that all the saber rattling about getting rid of Johnson has yet to come to pass. Democrats seem to have appreciated the way that Johnson comported himself, in contrast to the last time we went through this evolution. And Johnson himself has had this sort of media glow up. I mean, he's getting really good news cycle out of this, and that doesn't necessarily endear you to Republicans. But I think he did the right thing, perhaps later than people might have hoped. But, you know, he, in the last month, I think, started to appreciate both the power that he possesses and the inevitability of some of these things, in the sense that the more you delay, the more you drag out the pain. And at a certain point, you just have to take these things head on. So I think that is a positive development. You know, I think we have to be careful about getting carried away about what this means going forward, because there's going to be headwinds for him. And, you know, of course, it's going to be a tough November for House Republicans to hold the chamber. But if we think that Trump has a good night and, you know, Republicans are at least in the game here, you know, it's probably a toss up or close to it. If Republicans hold the majority, which they're not really expected to in terms of conventional wisdom, he is somebody that I wouldn't have said this a month ago or even a couple weeks ago. You could conceivably see him as the next speaker in the next Congress. So I think that is a pretty significant development there.
Yeah. Zach, how'd you react?
You know, one thing I just want to toss out there, with every glowing profile in Politico, The New Yorker, whatever, it does seem a little bit more likely to me that he's going to be vacated. I think those are very, very much not helpful to him. They're fascinating reads, and I think that many of them are accurate. Look, I'm a Democratic political consultant, so I think it probably goes without saying I'm not a huge fan of Mike Johnson. However, I think it's important to say when somebody does a good job, he did a good job. This was extremely difficult. 69% of likely Trump voters do not support aid to Ukraine. Only 29% of Republicans see Russia as an enemy. And over 60% of Republicans overall do not want to send aid to Ukraine. He made a tough call, and he has, you know, he's got more information at his disposal than the average person. He's getting the security briefings. He's seeing the classified information. And so I think he made a courageous decision that was the right decision for the country. And while I'm not a fan broadly, I feel proud as an American, and I think this was a good moment.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we're going to see more of this for the rest of the session, or if this might be pretty much as far as it goes in terms of leadership. I'm wondering, like, first of all, do you think we're going to see more of this kind of stand up to the base kind of leadership from Mike Johnson? And is there a case to be made here for supporting normie Republicans? God, not that he is a normie Republican, right? But this is encouraging.
I'll say this. I think the reason this happened in this case and in the case of the appropriations, and remember, in both cases, he had to use some structural creativity and some sort of procedural fig leaves to try to arrange the politics in a way that both gave his members cover to sort of selectively vote for what they wanted to, which was, I think, a brilliant touch. And it actually... And even if you listen to like Ro Khanna on the Sunday shows, even Democrats appreciated that because it enabled them to, let's say, vote in a principled way against Israel without sort of bringing down the whole package. So it was really a masterstroke in that regard. It, of course, took Democratic help on the procedural votes to get to that point. So I think, Dems are probably grumbling a little bit not to get more credit than they have. But the reason this happened in this case and the reason it happened with appropriations is because those things had to pass. There's really nothing else. If you're looking out on the horizon, there's an FAA bill that has to pass, May 10th, or, they might kick the can a little bit, but that's parochial. The hangups aren't partisan. And not only that, but people are trying to put other things on it, knowing that it's the last train out before the election. So I wouldn't expect this to become a habit, mostly because there's not a necessity. It requires the pressure. And I mean, remember, in both cases, all Johnson was trying to do was let the House work its will in a way that didn't blow back on him. So when we're looking at the rest of the year, once they get through FAA, which won't really be a problem to get done with, they're going to head into September, do a CR to the end of the year and a farm bill extension that just pushes everything into the lame duck. So that'll be the question is, are there any lessons that are learned from here for how to get through those evolutions? I think that's more of a suspension proposition, but the lame duck will be very interesting of what coalitions make sense to form. And that'll be determined by the politics and the implications of the election itself. So I think this is important for building trust between the parties, between the leaders and between Congress and the administration, but this is not some sudden outbreak of good tidings and legislative productivity.
A thing that I just want to add to that, when Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of gave her remarks after everything passed, she said that she wants people to go home and hear from their constituents, right? And we know that, again, the majority of Republicans did not want this to pass. That, to me, is a real wild card. What is the extent of the vitriol going to be? How motivated is the Republican base going to be to basically light up their elected officials when they see them these next couple weeks? And what impact is that going to have between now and the election? I don't know if that's going to lead to more kind of... values-based votes, stuff that has no chance of passing, but it's kind of a statement. And I don't know, also, maybe it's a little more low-key than we expect, and maybe this is something to build on. I think Liam's exactly right. I wouldn't expect much between now and Election Day, but this is the kind of thing that can build trust and lead to actually some good things happening down the road.
Two things that Zach's point reminds me is, one, exactly right. I mean, they're going to go back and try to raise hell. If you listen to the Bannon podcast, yeah. I pray for you, but it's a good way to sort of to experience what that other frequency is hearing. And he's on the warpath and trying to make things happen. I think part of why they did this, and they did this now to rip the Band-Aid off, is because people just want to pivot to, let's focus on the real enemy. Let's go beat Biden. Let's go win some races. Dragging it out wasn't going to help that. So I think they're going to try to pivot to that and get away from the sort of circular firing squad. But in the interest of that, the decision of the speaker to lead a bunch of members up to the steps of Columbia University and pick a fight with the activist students, getting booed by blue-haired teenagers, I think is probably helpful for building some of that team spirit that's lacking. And so I think that's the kind of tactical flourish that you'll see to try to head off what Zach's talking about, which is look, the reason that we haven't talked about Trump yet, but the reason Trump laid off, he appreciates at some level that it's not helpful for him for Republicans to be beating each other up on this. And I think he also appreciates at some level, unlike immigration, and you mentioned Biden shouting out this didn't have immigration with it. We've talked about this a million times on the show, but the reason that got left out and was probably good politics for Republicans to leave it out is that that truly divides the base on a deep, deep level. There's no winning that. There's no incremental win there for them. Whereas Ukraine, they'll blow off some steam, but that is not something that's like a core proposition for the party.
You know, like many Americans, when Johnson became speaker, my initial reaction was basically, who the fuck is that guy? And now yep. I think my question is, wait a second, is he actually pretty good at this? And it, based on how this shook out, it seems like he is a more than competent leader for the Republican House Coalition Conference.
The one thing I would add to that point, I think it's a really good one, is just taking away abilities and sort of competence. I think the baggage that McCarthy built up over time with Democrats and their presumption of good faith with Johnson, because he's nothing if not an earnest guy. I mean, he's a completely guileless, like very,
you know, like Ned Flanders.
Everything from his, everything from his aesthetic to the way he comports himself. If you know, the clips of him when people were trying to determine, like Zach said, who the hell is this guy? There were clips of him that kind of went viral and you're like, wait, this guy sounds like totally normal and like somebody that's like genuine. And it's everything. Like, I think Kevin McCarthy's a really like smart political operator in that sense. But he was nothing if not a slippery character who you know, is everything Johnson's not. And I think that, that shift, like not only just was it good to hit the reset button and we go, okay, maybe this is a guy we can deal with. Whereas there were so many strikes against McCarthy in Democrats' minds, the contrast itself is very helpful to Johnson in that the things that they hated about McCarthy are not present with Johnson, even if they think he is like McCarthy didn't believe any of this stuff, but Johnson does. But at least Johnson's sort of a genuine person that maybe we can trust in a way that we couldn't with Kevin.
That is so on the money, because McCarthy, you use the word slippery, and that's exactly right. He's a guy without principles. And Mike Johnson, while we might not agree with his principles necessarily, he is clearly deeply principled, and that makes him a much better faith negotiator because he's consistent. And McCarthy, you know, in one room was a completely different person than he was in another one sometimes.
Speaking of good faith negotiating, I think in all of our, let's call it measured praise of Mike Johnson, I say measured because I think Mike Murphy said this is like, you know, a Boy Scout gets medal for telling the truth kind of a moment. but I think we need to, you know, tip our hats to the way the White House played this and Democratic leadership played this, because in the run-up to this deal, they were notably calm. There were no attacks at Mike Johnson. There were no attacks at Mike Johnson, not from Schumer, not from the White House, not from Jeffries. And I think it showed considerable restraint on the part of Democrats to demagogue this, even though they knew they knew Mike Johnson was going to have a tough time getting this through with his base. And Biden waited until after it was signed to go to have his press conference and take a swing at Republicans on not including border security, right? They very much played nice with Republicans in order to get this done. And I think this is a rare, proud moment for a cooperation between Congress and the White House, as you noted, Liam.
What Biden knew and what his people around him knew, I think, was that their biggest hurdle to begin with, and the reason this took so long, was that their best lever was the Senate. And until the Senate acted, there would be no pressure on the House. So for the longest time, Johnson was insulated by his allies in the Senate and the fact that there wasn't critical mass within the Republican conference to jam the House and put Johnson in this position. When they finally ran out of patience and they dropped the border business and they sent that bill over, Johnson was on the clock. And what Biden appreciated rightly was the minute the Senate sent that over, Johnson couldn't do nothing. That wasn't an option. And the best pressure point wasn't Biden. And in fact, Biden could only be counterproductive. It was letting the will of the House and the needs of his conference, because that's the job of the speaker. You know, you go from being somebody who has one vote and who can posture themselves however they want to somebody who, as Zach said, like gets the intel, has a duty not only to his members, but to the chamber, to the country, and it changes your prerogatives in a lot of ways. And so maybe he could have done nothing and this would have been discharged. But when the overwhelming majority of the House wants to get this done and the pressure builds, I think that's when you realize, okay, you can lay back and let this happen to you and you get no credit, or you take it head on and you see what we're seeing, which is like getting probably more credit than he deserves. And yeah, sure, maybe Marjorie Taylor Greene will come after him, but in the immediate term, that's not really a problem. And quite frankly, is there anything to say that if this happened to you and you were shown as weak and ineffectual, that she wouldn't come after you then? So I think, you know, Biden was smart about it, but this had so much to do with people didn't appreciate it at the time. But when the Senate sent that bill over, that was it. Something was going to pass. It didn't have to be this exactly, but something was going to pass.
These are four serious issues and our leaders behaved accordingly. And I actually think this is sort of a thing that represents some of the best of American politics. It's politics working, right? I mean, we got meaningful funding for Taiwan, for Israel, for Ukraine. We're going to have a TikTok ban go into effect, which is deeply important because of the threat that, that TikTok, you know, represents. And I think this is a good moment. Ron, I know you agree with some of that, but not the TikTok part.
I'm just shaking my head at like going to go into effect. Like hold that thought because yeah. I am skeptical that it's going to go into effect, and it's certainly not going to go into effect before the election. There are serious First Amendment concerns.
I wish they banned it today.
Well, yeah,
I don't want to take us down too much of a tangent, but I do think it's fascinating to see that you know it really even to the extent that it doesn't go into effect. Watching the kicking and screaming from the allies of ByteDance or of TikTok. Look, this isn't about a ban. It's fundamentally not about a ban because if this is about making money, right. which is like, that's the capitalistic idea of what this would be. You can liquidate and make a ton of money. Maybe you leave a little bit of money on the table. Maybe the investors take a little bit of a haircut relative to what they expected. But this just proves the hawks sentiment that this isn't about money or fiduciary duty. This is about data. This is about national security. And so I can't think of a worse posture from those folks than kicking and screaming about a ban when it's like, well, no, it's not banned if you just cash out and make your money.
I tweeted about this morning. We banned Four Loko because like two college kids got drunk and died and we'd moved fast on it, right?
I'll never forget.
Yeah.
Schumer had that press conference about Fort Loco the fall of, I think, October of 2010. And I'll never forget buying up the last of like the Fort Locos and bringing him into the majority room. Actually, I think it was the second floor conference room in the NRSC. And we slept there because we were hitting flights the next morning, but drinking my Fort Locos from the NRSC. And it was from my cold, dead hands. They were going to take these real Fort Locos.
Fort Loco, we moved very quickly on because it did some bad stuff. TikTok is exponentially worse, and it's impacting the youth, but it's impacting everybody. And I think it's good that at least we're taking some kind of proactive action here.
Let's go from Four Loko to college campuses where they belong. during last week's roundup with Susan Del Percio and Hagar Shamali, I mentioned the protests at Columbia because Hagar teaches there, and she had to come directly from Columbia to the studio when we were taping. She was a little bit behind because she got held up by all the chaos. We also mentioned a student-led Hamas recruiting event that she became aware of and had to report to the FBI, and had some pretty horrifying stories about what's been happening there. And that was before things escalated over the weekend. While we were recording that episode, over 100 people were arrested by the NYPD. They then tried to break up the encampment. Ilhan Omar's daughter was among the people arrested. And since then, the protests have only grown, and we are now seeing these encampments and protests at and around NYU, Yale, Harvard, USC, University of Minnesota, University of Michigan, UT Austin, Berkeley, and probably more by the time you hear this. About 120 people were arrested at NYU, 50 people arrested at Yale. There have been some sickening sights in and around the universities. Right outside of Columbia, protesters telling Jewish people to go back to Poland. On campus, Jewish counter-protesters were gathered wearing and waving Israeli flags. Another student posed for a photo right next to them, holding a sign pointing at them saying, Al-Qassam's next targets. Al-Qassam is Hamas's military arm. Also, it is misspelled on the poster. Hagar Shamali, as I mentioned, walked by two posters of known terrorists at Columbia. Off campus near Columbia, a masked protester was recorded yelling, "We are Hamas." Also off campus near Columbia, protesters chanted, "Burn Tel Aviv to the ground." Many Jewish students at Columbia in particular have said they don't feel safe on campus. There's reporting that they've been harassed and are concerned for their safety. A Jewish student at Yale was stabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag by a protester. An Orthodox rabbi who works at Columbia sent a message to nearly 300 Jewish students on Sunday recommending that they return home. Biden issued a statement, quote, "While every American has the right to peaceful protest, calls for violence and physical intimidation targeting Jewish students and the Jewish community are blatantly anti-Semitic, unconscionable, and dangerous. They have absolutely no place on any college campus or anywhere in the United States of America, and echoing the rhetoric of terrorist organizations, especially in the wake of the worst massacre committed against the Jewish people since the Holocaust, is despicable. We condemn these statements in the strongest terms." Hamas put out a statement supporting the protests. The supreme leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, has also made a statement of support. Columbia has asked faculty to try to make classes hybrid or allow for virtual learning this week. Classes do end on Monday. Scott Galloway, who's a professor at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G pod, not Professor G, he's too hip for that, and co-host of the podcast Pivot with Kara Swisher, he talked about the double standard for speech on campus on Morning Joe this week. Let's take a listen.
And I do think there is a double standard. I walked by NYU last night. What I saw was peaceful protest. But I can tell you, if I went into the NYU Square with a white hood on and said, "Lynch the blacks or burn the gays," my ID would be shut off by that night. And I would never work in academia again. There would be no need for the words context or nuance. I wouldn't be protected by terms like First Amendment or free speech. I would be out of the world of academia. It seems like we have a double standard when it comes to hate speech, as long as it's against Jews.
These protests on college campuses are coming as organizers start to plan protests for this summer when the DNC is in Chicago. Shout out to Stephen from Maryland, by the way, who wrote in to Politicology and brought this to our attention. They say they want to give the delegates a 1968 kind of welcome. That's a reference to the infamously bloody Democratic National Convention in Chicago. They are planning to protest Genocide Joe, as they call him, for backing Israel in the war against Hamas. Chicago Alderman Gilbert Villegas, who's a Democrat, compared these anti-DNC protesters to the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. It's not entirely clear how much this is going to hurt Biden in November, but a spectacle at the convention would certainly inflict some damage, depending on how he handles it, especially. It is worth noting, Biden has seen major erosion with younger voters since 2020. In 2020, he was up 29 points among 18 to 34-year-olds. In March of this year, he was up only plus 5. But most of that drop was actually before October 7th. People started paying attention to polling a lot more after 10-7. But in CNN's reporting, Biden was already only plus 11. Before Hamas's attack. So, broad question to kick it off here. What were your reactions to seeing these protests, Zach?
Yeah, you know, to me, these protests are not about Columbia University. They're not about higher education broadly. I think that is certainly a kind of a subplot. But I think what I'm focused on is there is a rising tide of anti-Semitism worldwide, right? And it's manifesting in all kinds of places and all kinds of unfortunate ways. And I think we're seeing that on college campuses right now. I also think, though, a couple of different things can be true at once, right? So you do have this rising tide of anti-Semitism. The Hamas attack that started the war was horrific, should be roundly condemned, and I think has by most kind of reasonable actors. But we would be kidding ourselves if we didn't at least acknowledge that Netanyahu has been disastrous. And I think that some of the actions that he's taken have certainly made it harder to be sympathetic, right? I also think like there is a rich history of college students protesting wars, both just and unjust, and things getting out of hand, right? So when I'm watching this, I'm not watching it through the lens of this is all totally new, this is all out of nowhere. I think it's important that we kind of look at this through a global lens, and that extends to why do the kids feel this way? It's because of where they're getting their news and how they're getting their news. They're not getting their news filtered through the Western lens. They're getting it from TikTok. They're getting it from social media. They are seeing, you know, so here's a great example. You can watch on TikTok a video of a young Palestinian woman talking about the hardships that they're experiencing, right? That is a very, very different window into conflict than watching NBC News cover the invasion of Baghdad, right? And so the shifting media landscape, the rising tides of anti-Semitism, the history of protests on college campuses, these things are all coming together. But it is coming together in a really frightening way because, Ron, to I think some things we've talked about offline, there are kids that are saying stuff that I really, really hope they don't know fully what they mean. But like, there is a frightening certainty and there's a frightening comfort with the use of political violence. And that, I think, is at least new-ish.
Yeah, I got thoughts, but Liam, go ahead.
What's striking to me, if you look at the data of what young people generally care about, even on campuses, really, the Harvard poll, that the most recent one, they pulled 16 different issues, the entire imaginable range of policy issues. Israel and Palestine was second to last, actually, ironically, right above student debt. So these issues that the Biden administration has been tying themselves in knots over are definitely huge issues for a certain subset of key coalition members and activist groups. It's not really what 18 to 29 year olds generally care about, at least according to the data. So what does that say? I mean, it's sort of the real life version of Twitter not being real life. Activists, trends are not real life at any meaningful scale. These are kids, searching for meaning and finding it in this one thing they can be passionate about. And so, shaping your foreign policy around that probably isn't a wise move. In terms of what the political knock-on effects are, I think so much of this election, in terms of the shaping the final 10% of people that are actually persuadable and trying to figure out what they're going to do, many of whom probably dislike both of these choices. It's going to be about the psychology involved and the permission structures involved. So I think anything that reinforces an ugly version of what the left stands for and reinforces the idea of a binary where I don't like Trump, but it's too important, we can't have these crazy leftists take over. That's the kind of thing that would push like a Haley voter or somebody that maybe was a third party voter in 16, but voted for Biden in 2020 is now disillusioned. Those are the sorts of voters that I think see this and are turned off by it. So that's one thing that I'm thinking about in terms of watching this. We have mini protests popping up around my office here with the GW guys trying to do their best Columbia impression, but it hasn't quite caught on.
Yeah. One thing I want to put on the table is just how similar this is. Actually, it's not similar. It's far worse, actually, in terms of the kinds of things these students are saying. Everybody remembers Charlottesville 2017, Jews will not replace us, and how the left, rightly, and sort of normal people lost their minds at this display of blatant anti-Semitism, marching with torches, Jews will not replace us. We're now hearing on the campus left, gas the Jews, burn Tel Aviv, right? We want all of we don't want 68. We want the entire territory of Israel. We want to essentially wipe it off the map. And what I'm not seeing is liberals sort of lose their minds at those displays of anti-Semitism. And I think this is the double standard that Scott Galloway was getting at. And why does this matter? Okay, fine. The campus left doesn't matter, but these people are also shutting down bridges, causing sort of disorder and chaos outside of campuses. And so part of the strategy behind these protests is getting them to spread. And they put this in a leaflet. So I'm going to quote from the leaflet, and then I want to talk about the DNC in Chicago, because ultimately, if this becomes an image that is associated with Biden and the Democratic Party, then I think there is bigger political problems, right? Quote, an occupation needs to spread in order to survive. New buildings need to be taken on campus, throughout the city, and across the country. Take the enemy by surprise. Strive for daily or even hourly successes, however small. At all costs, retain superior morale. Talk about the DNC convention, Zach, and the risk you see to this being a spectacle that could hurt Biden in November.
Yeah, well, I think there is some historical precedent for a DNC convention in Chicago going a bit off the rails. So certainly that is a concern. I actually want to go back to what you just read for a moment. So I understand that is, hearing that, it sounds aggressive at best, right? That is very common language on college campuses. It was common when I was in college. There's any number of revolutionary handbooks, right? And especially on elite university campuses, you've got these kids that are so far removed from meaningful consequences. Like, they're going to go get fantastic jobs after this, right? And they kind of are playing revolutionary. And so they adapt and kind of embrace this language. And I don't want to say it's a phase, but it's for show. It's performative for many of them. Now, that is not true across the board. There are some folks out there that I think are really, their level of commitment, you know, borders on zeal and fanaticism. But a lot of kids are just playing, they're just playing revolutionary. You know, they got the Che Guevara poster in their dorm room. And that's not to excuse it, but I think that's just to provide some context there. Going back though to the convention, look, do I think that this is something that is going to have a massive impact on Biden? No. Do I think it's something that could move a small segment of voters in a few states and that could be the thing that tips the scales? Yeah, it could. I mean, look, how bad are the scenes going to be? How motivated are the protesters? Are they going to disrupt the entire convention? Are they going to be inside? Are they going to be shouting down Biden? How are the police going to respond? How is Biden going to respond to the police response? Like, there are any number of things that can go wrong here. And I empathize with those that feel so passionately about this issue and want to make a positive contribution. But I can assure you, if you are one of these protesters and you're listening, the most effective route is not to disrupt the DNC convention. It is like the alternative is not going to be better. And that, I think, is the thing that, you know, for older folks watching these protests, I think we feel frustrated about, right? It's like the things you're doing are not actually going to make your cause more likely to succeed. So why are you doing them? Is it to feel a certain way, or do they just have a totally different opinion about the outcome of their actions?
If we think about what the goal of a convention is, it's to build up your message and to frame the home stretch of the election, come out with a bounce and, you know, go towards victory. And the problem is, because of the history here and because of the ready-made narratives, the problem is no matter what happens, that's all the media is going to be talking about. The lead up is going to be all about 68. It's going to be all about these comparisons. And so whatever happens, whether it does fulfill that and, or, you know, in some sort of pale imitation and they can draw those comparisons, or it doesn't, it's going to be about that, unfortunately, rather than the speeches, rather than the themes, rather than the things Democrats want to talk about. So that's the problem, is, you know, just talk about unlucky selection here. You know, when they selected the convention site, they couldn't have known that this conflict was going to be what was bubbling up at the time. But it's just an unfortunate sort of fluke of history. I think Zach is exactly right. But you can't avoid that, because that is irresistible to a media that's trying to fill column inches, that's trying to fill 24-hour news cycles. You're going to be showing those images. You're going to see, you know, 68 cops. You're going to see, you know, all of the craziness, and, you know, the activists know that, and at some level probably play into that.
Liam, I think, is so on the money about the ready-made narrative. It makes it even easier. It's gonna make it spread further and faster. And, you know, for older voters in particular, they're gonna have familiarity with it. So yeah, I totally agree there. One thing I just want to kind of throw to the group though is that every post World War II generation has become increasingly less supportive of Israel. And when you look at the numbers, particularly for those under 30 right now, it's deeply concerning. I remember when I was a kid, my grandparents, both of whom on my dad's side had fought in World War II in some capacity, they said that when our generation dies out, people are going to forget what happened and they're not going to believe it. I'm curious if y'all kind of had similar experiences, because I mean, I remember saying that and be like, what are you talking about? Like, when I was a kid, I didn't understand. And I think, unfortunately, that generation very well might be right.
Do you guys think there is something? Okay, how do you reckon with the trajectory of the chants and calls at these protests that began with, they began on October 8th, while there were still terrorists inside Israel and the IDF were trying to track down the terrorists who had just massacred Israelis. Students for Justice in Palestine wrote a letter sort of in full solidarity with Palestine, sort of celebrating this historic moment for the Palestinian resistance, as they put it. Okay, so that's how it started. But these protests started with chants of ceasefire now. But they're not chanting ceasefire now anymore. We've moved on from ceasefire now to gas the Jews and destroy Israel. What do you make of the trajectory of the demands, of the calls for violence, and where does this ultimately go? Why has it escalated like that?
Man, the certainty of youth. You know, I think that the reason so many protest movements start with young people is because they haven't been beaten down by adulthood and the world and reality enough to think that they can't make a difference or that things can't change. And so it starts out, you know, with a righteousness and a certainty of righteousness, when then put into an echo chamber can have really bad outcomes, right? And so I think, look, I think a lot of these kids, even the ones saying horrible things, they care deeply. They believe that they are on the right side of history and that they are making a positive contribution. But echo chambers combined with certainty of righteousness leads to bad outcomes, no matter what you're fighting for.
And I think Zach's describing what's always been true and grown over time, but you layer on the incentive structure of the current media environment and social media channels, and the fact that like these transgressive, you know, contrarian positions do numbers, and you know that it's there is an analog on the right. It's not the same thing, but it's the same reason why you have. I don't want to compare these people to like Groypers, but like there is a market on the right for just saying outlandish stuff that is obviously offensive and obviously like beyond the pale. And there's that weird line between irony and seriousness that's just like at a, you know, it's the law of goats, but it's like I think it's similar in the sense that it's very easy to get carried away with your own righteousness, but then get lost in like there's the weird. I mean, think about the communities that form online. I mean, you get reinforced by whether it's the you know. There's sort of the Chapo tanky wing. There's all kinds of weird stuff flowing around at all times. And you lose track of like, am I being ironic? Am I serious? Like who knows? But I'm saying it, and at a certain level, it gets internalized.
Let's talk about silos. Speaking of information silos, Joe Biden could become the first president in over 60 years not to do a formal interview with a New York Times reporter, unless that changes before he leaves office. He has not given a formal interview with the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal since taking office either. Axios looked at this for both Biden and Trump, and they said, call it the safe space election. Biden is more likely to talk to mainstream outlets and Trump to echo chambers. Both of them are only giving interviews with friendly reporters, basically. For example, Biden has been on the Smart List podcast with celebrities Jason Bateman, Sean Hayes, Will Arnett, twice. He has also done sit-downs with New York Times opinion columnists, David Brooks, Tom Friedman. He did an interview with an historian, Heather Cox Richardson. He did a podcast interview about grief with Anderson Cooper, CNN's Fareed Zakaria, 60 Minutes' Scott Pelley, and Enrique Acevedo with Univision. He also had about 568 short Q&A exchanges with reporters, but no sit-downs with print reporters. Trump has also stuck with friendly media. He did call into CNBC in March and Spectrum News One Wisconsin, but the rest have been with Fox News and ideological outlets, as Axios described them. He also did a sit-down with Nigel Farage at Mar-a-Lago. one of Trump's friendliest reporters is Brian Glenn, who is the director of programming at Right Side Broadcasting Network. Politico described Right Side as like NFL red zone for Trump rallies. He also happens to be dating Marjorie Taylor Greene. So what do you think the strategy is here for both camps? And you can start wherever you want, but Liam, why don't you take it away?
Well, I mean, these guys, both of them for a variety of reasons, see risk in going on even mildly adversarial or, you know, let's just call them objective mainstream outlets because they have friendly organs they can speak to and they can control the environment. And so that makes sense. I mean, to the extent this is a base mobilization proposition for winning this election, that's where you meet people where they are. And then the real question is, okay, I mentioned that, like, let's say it's 10%, let's say it's 7-8%, the people that are going to decide this, whether they stay home and if they turn out who they choose among, what do those people listen to? If you think about these outlets that you're mentioning, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they don't have the sway that they used to. They don't have the broad audience that they used to. So the real question is, okay, the profile of the undecided voter is probably a low information vote right now. They're not a hyper, the heavy news appetite, New York Times power user, Wall Street Journal subscriber. That's not who it is. And so figuring out who that is a key problem, but you're not going to find them by sitting down, whether or not it's sort of like, you know, a rite of passage or something that's appropriate for the president to do or a nominee to do. That's not as an election strategy. That probably doesn't make a lot of sense. So I don't even know that I blame them. And if you think about the attitude of the left generally, it's the Doug Balloon dynamic, right? I mean, it's just an ever-present meme now that like the New York Times just both sides everything, and they're constantly, you know, poking their audience, which is hyper-educated, left-leaning elites. And so, you know, why would you reward that behavior? I think that's their attitude, but I don't think that's why the White House is doing this. I think it's because they see risk and they see very little upside.
I think that's totally on the money. I think you just completely nailed the incentives, right? And so the only thing I have to add to that is they have two different weaknesses, but very clear weaknesses, right? So for Biden, he's just so old and he looks so old and he sounds so old. It's not going to be difficult for an even mildly hostile interviewer to make him look ancient and senile and out of it. And I don't think that he's senile, but he does look and sound very, very old, right? Then you've got Trump, who's maybe the most undisciplined person on the planet. And, you know, he's a criminal defendant and a bunch of different stuff. So, of course, they want to be careful with what he gets asked and all that. But I just find myself really disappointed with where we are, because at the end of the day, elected officials, they don't just represent their base. They represent all of their constituents. They're supposed to be serving the needs of not just their base, all their constituents. And I think it's sort of impossible to make the case that they're doing that when they won't even talk to the outlets that of folks that are not going to be voting to them for them listen to or read. I think that we need to ask more and demand more of our elected officials, especially at the highest level. You know, I've tweeted about this a couple times where, you know, I say, I wish that Biden was doing more of these. I think that he should be doing more of these. As I do, and I feel the same way for Trump. I think I'm, you know, kind of focused on Biden for a number of reasons. And over and over and over again, the response that I see, you know, it's Twitter, not real life, but I also heard this in real life, is, well, why would they go on? You know, what do they get out of it? And it's like, well, it's their civic duty. That's why they would go on.
Can I just like lament the thing that's really being lost here?
Yeah.
Which I think, Zach, you're getting at, which is thanks to this perpetual campaign that we are in and these decisions about who to talk to being driven primarily by politics and who's gonna read them means that we are only ever, I think most of the coverage is only ever focused on the political dynamics, and we miss the policies. We miss good, robust debate, discussion about the merits of any given policy proposal. Not a lot of that happens in mainstream news. That's a lot. That's where I think you would see some of this be teased out by a good, and Zach, you said hostile journalist, but I would just say a properly adversarial interview between an objective-minded journalist and someone with enormous power. And we aren't getting that. So I think like the thing that to me is getting lost here is we should be debating policy. We should see a lot of pushback and testing of what the White House says they want to do. And like, if you know where to look for that stuff, you can find it. But it certainly isn't in mainstream outlets, I think, very much. There's a lot of cheerleading that goes on both sides, and I think it means there's less of a focus on actual policy making.
You know, I also think what this strategy shows is that the staff of both candidates fundamentally doesn't trust them to do media. I mean, I think, look, the people that work for Trump have made the decision that it is bad for him to do even the slightest, you know, difficult media. The people who work for Biden have made the same calculus. And like, what greater indictment of the political realities than that? That the people who work for the two leading candidates for president do not trust them to do a tough interview. That's outrageous. And I think, not to be morbid here, but look, you know, one's 81, the other's 78 or whatever. So at the end of the day, at some point in the not so distant future, we will have leaders where that hopefully won't have the same type of weaknesses. And I think it's important that we start now calling for a return to some of the stuff we're talking about, because it's not going to happen with Trump and Biden, but whoever's next, we can't have this precedent stand of only doing friendly interviews.
This is a slightly different question, but it goes to one of the biggest remaining variables in terms of sort of the known unknowns that we have in the next 6 months that are going to help to determine this election. And it's, do these guys see the incentives in debating? It's not an outlet, but it's that risk reward of why this isn't a controlled environment. Things might go off the rails. You know, what's the upside versus the downside? And so I think that's going to be the interesting thing. And I personally think Biden, if he's getting good advice, has to. It would be a loser to not do it, because he would look scared in a way that Trump, I think the presumption is that, you know, he's sort of game, he's a wrecking ball, he'll come through and do it either way. But it kind of does let Trump off the hook. You know, he'd probably sit there with an empty podium or something. But I think, you know, it's a stand-in for the same issue, which is, you know, is there a civic obligation to do this? And how does that intersect with the political incentives?
If y'all worked for Biden or Trump, would you recommend they do a debate? Like what would, if you worked for them, what would your strategy be?
I think you got to do one. You got to get up there. You got to survive it. You know, you don't need to, you just need to stay on your feet, you know? And I think it's the judges will score it on points, and your side will, I mean, the bar is so low for Biden. And I think think about the State of the Union, right? Like, that's a constitutional obligation. So he could have sent the letter like, you know, the presidents of old, but he needed to do it, and he acquitted himself fairly well. Like, people didn't expect anything. Yep. And because the bar is so low, you get a nice news cycle out of it. So if you go up there and don't drool on yourself and don't, you know, pass out, I mean, that's all it takes. And so I think it's obviously in his interest to do it, and it would be a problem not to do it. I wouldn't go back to the well again. I'd probably take my one, and you know, that's probably it. But I don't think you can afford not to.
Wait, I want to co-sign Liam. I think he has to do one debate, and the reason is Trump wants as many as possible. Biden wants zero. Right? He wants to not have to do this at all, because it's far riskier for Biden than it is for Trump. I think. Here's the reason. Political attacks tend to work best when they resonate with something people already believe is true. That plays to Biden's disadvantage in this case, because if he doesn't do it, and we had a whole plus conversation about this several weeks ago, where we talked about Bill Kristol, who I admire and respect a lot, saying Biden shouldn't do it, right? And we thought, oh, I can't believe somebody's actually saying that like good advice would be not to, right? Exactly. I think he's got to do it. But if he doesn't do it, it plays directly into the Biden trope from 2020, and it makes him look weak, makes him look like he's hiding. Trump doesn't suffer from that same sort of preconception image problem, and that's why I think he has to do at least one.
I think you're right, but I think you're missing one piece of information. Trump is a criminal defendant with multiple trials, right? There is a risk factor for him around that simply does not exist for Joe Biden, and has never existed for any other presidential candidate in history, right? And that, to me, is the wild card. I think if there's only one debate, is that going to be the highest stakes debate in American presidential history?
I mean, when was the last time we didn't have a presidential debate?
Not in my lifetime, that's for sure.
I don't know. Not in my lifetime either. But really quickly, before we move on to look aheads, we got a couple of minutes. What do you guys think of the image of Trump's courtroom antics and these sort of these little tirades he's going on, and whether or not this helps him or hurts him in the we're now in a general, right? He's not playing to his base anymore. I mean, he is, but he shouldn't be, right? What do you think?
I can't believe I have to say this, but I think that, like, generally speaking, being a criminal defendant while you're running for president is a net negative. You know, like the notion that this is somehow going to help him, which is, for whatever reason, the most like galaxy-brained consultant take I've ever heard, is somewhat prevalent. Like, yeah, I think he looks bad. I think he looks petulant and childish, where he's like, oh, it's really cold in the courtroom. This is a travesty. It's like, well, my man, like, I hate to tell you this, there's not a criminal defendant that gets to set the temperature in a courtroom. I think he looks weak. I think that
he's constrained.
Yeah. I think, like, also, look, this is a guy who's, we talked about echo chambers earlier. Can't imagine many people that are in more of an echo chamber than he is. the first day when he was sitting there having to listen to people be like, here's what I think about Donald Trump. I don't know if I can be objective because I think he's such a shitbag. Like, when was the last time, if ever, he went through something like that?
I think the, except to the extent that, I mean, there's sort of three levels to this. One is the theater, right? And so to the extent it produces content or news bites that pierce the sort of cocoon he's been in, because part of what's benefited him over the last, 2 years has been sort of exiled from a media standpoint. He hasn't driven the news cycle. Biden's been the one mostly in the news. Trump has sort of flown below the radar, or at least been on sort of a different frequency. As of yet, it's still early. I've heard more about the OJ trial in the last couple of weeks than I have the Trump trial. And that's with somebody lighting themselves on fire outside the thing. So the threshold for making news and making people raise their eyebrows is so much higher than it ever was. I don't know. Like my attitude was always, this isn't like the trials aren't necessarily bad as from the legal standpoint, so much as they are, if it puts Trump front and center and puts him in a negative light in the news in a way that breaks through, that is bad. We haven't seen that yet. Maybe we will, but that hasn't happened yet. So the other level is, well, okay, is it adjudicated in time for it to matter? And if so, that matters. Clearly, a negative ruling would be bad. I think a ruling that comes out in some sort of hung jury or whatever, like that's potentially very helpful to him. And to Zach's point, I think people conflated at some level, like this, there's no doubt that being persecuted, the idea of victimhood and lawfare helped him in the primary. We're not in the primary anymore. And I don't think that matters, except insofar as we're talking about bringing people home, putting on their jerseys. There are probably themes you can hit on that, but you're right. I mean, this is frustrating to him to the extent that his behavior reflects that. And he acts out in ways that remind people who he is and why we went away from him in the first place. That's unhelpful. But I think for the time being, it's kind of, it's a tree falling in the woods. It's for news junkies to think about and parse all the meaning. And there really isn't for the sort of relatively low information people who are probably going to decide this election. Nobody's deciding how they feel about these guys based on what happens in this trial.
Just from a pure campaign tactics perspective, having a candidate who's committed this often to non-campaign activities, like that is logistically challenging.
That's
too.
That's tough.
I mean, look, I don't know if he's doing a ton of call time, but he certainly isn't while he's in court, right?
The bizarre caveat to that, and I think it's absolutely, in a conventional sense, it's obviously right. At the same time, if you could just lock him away in the basement, the sort of Trump version of the basement campaign, that's probably the ideal. So in a weird way, so long as nobody's watching the trial or paying attention to the trial, having him stuck and not doing other things maybe is like a loss aversion strategy. But yeah, I mean, it's not helpful. And then it becomes the question, as you said, Zach, you sort of intimated this, like the money disparity is going to be crazy. And it truly becomes this interesting political science experiment. Does any of that matter? When you have 100% name ID and two former presidents, does that matter? It'll matter maybe at a race-to-race level down the ticket, but at a presidential macro level, maybe for voter mobilization, but like the spend on TV, let's be honest, that's not going to matter.
Liam, do you think that, you just reminded me of something, that him being locked away might actually be an asset overall, might be because, it is helpful to the Trump campaign for especially swing voters to remember this sort of fantasy world of the Trump presidency that things were better for them then. The economy was better. We didn't have inflation to the degree that we have it now. Like they have a sort of a Vaseline on the camera lens sort of picture of what life was like under Trump. And if they actually had to see him on the campaign trail now, they would be forced to reckon with the person that he is. And since like he's sort of tucked away, chained to the courtroom, they don't have to deal with, showing everybody, because he's got problems now. He's like, he's a lot older than he was then. And he's got age problems, not to the degree that Biden does, but like it allows people to live in this, fantasy world of the past, and not remember, just how chaotic Trump's presidency was.
To your point, that's the single biggest challenge the Biden administration has. Democrats can pull their hair out about this as to why, but if you ask respondents right now, both from a relative standpoint, like whose policies did you prefer, or just objectively, how do you remember the Trump years versus how do you feel about the Biden years? People prefer then. And like, whatever you want to say about the nostalgia and the weird psychology there, Biden telling people that he's a bad guy is not going to change that. You kind of have to show. And I think Trump revealing himself in that way that brings people back to, oh yeah, that's why we moved away in 2020. That's the best he can hope for. Is that possible? I don't know. But anything that opens the door to those sorts of eureka moments at scale, I think that's what the Biden administration needs.
Okay, now that we're up to speed on a few of the biggest stories this week, and by the way, one other one that we should just mention is that while we are taping right now, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments in the Trump sort of immunity case, which is going to be enormously consequential when that decision comes down. So we don't have a whole lot to talk about right now other than it is happening as we tape. Let's find out what else our panel is paying attention to. Liam, what did you bring?
So I know about 2 weeks ago, when I was on, I mentioned the Congressional Review Act, which is the mechanism by which Congress can actually disapprove of rules, regulatory final rules from administrations in advance of that being truly in play. And I'll say, if you pause this and go to listen to the Lobby Shop episode, we just dropped a really good explainer on that if you want to do a deep dive on it.
Saw that. Yes.
I listened back to it yesterday. I thought it was great. So if that means anything to you, check it out. But the upshot is, in advance of that CRA window being operative, that 60-day look back being operative, the Biden administration is racing out all of the rules that they can potentially make final. So the big one that was rolled out today being Thursday, was the EPA 111 rule, their power plant rule. This is really kind of a reboot of something that the Obama administration tried that was ruled unconstitutional. Biden's taking a crack at this. It puts severe restrictions on what power plants can do. It requires them to use carbon capture technologies. It requires them to lower their emissions by 2032. Lots there, lots to unpack. But the upshot is, they're on the clock here. And this is sort of the cornerstone of their decarbonization regulatory policy. There's a suite of other things they rolled out. This is Earth Week. So there's like three or four EPA rules that are being pushed out. But keep an eye out for the next month, really. They're going to be racing everything they possibly can to the Federal Register to try to beat the clock on the Congressional Review Act, pending a potential Republican trifecta.
Zach, what'd you bring?
Well, I would say that I'm watching the Supreme Court, but I can't, which is outrageous. So I'm listening to the Supreme Court. There are some really, really big cases coming up, one of which you just mentioned a moment ago. That's all happening between now and the third week of June. And I think it's going to tell us an awful lot about the direction of our country. It's going to tell us an awful lot about the direction of the court, how much control Roberts has of it. And I think, you know, perhaps the biggest one right now is going to be the absolute immunity case, because it's not just enough for there to be a ruling. Like, it, in both directions, that ruling can have wide-reaching ramifications. And so, again, it's not just yes, no, one way or the other. It's the specifics within that yes, no are deeply, deeply important. And that's true, not just for that case, but, you know, a half dozen others at least.
Yeah, good point. I just want to put something on the radar, which we will certainly be talking about most likely in a long form episode coming up. Well, two things coming up in long form, but first is that the Biden administration finally, after a very long waiting period, has released their Title IX guidance, and new updated Title IX guidance, which has to do with college campuses and how they adjudicate, for example, allegations of sexual assault. And they are truly horrible. Truly, truly horrible. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, which does some really great work protecting free speech on campuses and protecting students' rights, has blasted it. And one of the key problems is that it essentially removes a lot of procedural due process protections for students who are accused of, for example, sexual assault, and including the right to confront your accuser, the right to confront the evidence against you. It's pretty bad. It's pretty dark. So we'll probably be talking about that a little bit more with a constitutional expert. The other thing I just want to look forward to is that I'm planning to have a conversation with an urban warfare expert to talk about what's really going on in Gaza and the reality of the war there, and how to understand what the, you know, the very difficult choices in front of the IDF and how they're prosecuting this war. So look forward to that. Also, before we head over to Politicology Plus, where can everybody find you on the internet, Liam?
On X, I am at LP Donovan. You plugged the Lobby Shop podcast. I would tell you to go listen to that CRA episode. And I do have a Substack that I write on from time to time, lpdonovan@substack.com.
Terrific. How about you, Zach?
Unfortunately, you can still find me on X. I'm at ZachCZ. You'd be better off deleting your account than following me. But if you insist on keeping it, please follow both Liam and myself. And hey, why not Ron in Politicology while you're at it?
All right. We'll talk to you next week. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.